mean, that's the thing about what's right about the Greek theory of the muse. I mean, how do you account for genius in an artistic sense?
Right. I mean, Locke, in one sense, Locke is the most despicable character, but yet he's also the most wise in another sense. And it's interesting that, in a sense, you could say that Locke gets the last word in Rheingold. He provides the final setting for Valkyrie, the second opera, by creating the Ring of Fire. And he, in a sense, gets the last word in the last opera.
Well, plus he's what's overcome in the third opera, in Siegfried, by the pure hero.
So, Loki's role is one that I feel like I'm still at the Hennin stage with him. That he sees everything, but also misses everything. He sees everything, but misses everything. Because he can't really love. Loki is incapable of loving himself, but yet he sees the dilemmas of everybody else. And he's kind of he sets the stage and the framework for everybody else's dilemma. But you can't really see him as
That's
the
right.
hero
no.
at all.
Oh no, he's not the hero, but he is almost the omniscient one. He sees everything before anybody else does. But he's incapable of, he is estranged from feeling it. That's the thing about, I mean, if you wanted to write an essay on Loke, that would be the theme that I would touch on, or the twin themes, that he sees everything, but he's incapable of feeling any of it.
Well, that's an interesting point, except that Loke is also shocked and amazed that, if I recall correctly, his long soliloquy in Rheingold, he's shocked and amazed that anybody might renounce love to achieve his power.
Yeah, but Loki himself is incapable of it either way. He's incapable of renouncing love because he's, in a sense, incapable of love.
Yeah, but then it's kind of doubly amazing that he can be so indignant and kind of shocked that anybody would, unless he's just doing that as a manipulation.
No, I think it's more empirical in his sense. He's able to take in all things and see all perspectives. In other words, he is the chorus. He understands all perspectives. But he himself really has no perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and it gets greater. I mean, in a sense, Rheingold is a great opera. And in one sense, it is the greatest of them. But in many other senses, it's the least of all the Ring.
Yeah, it's funny how you can almost make a similar comment about every opera in the Ring and every act within each opera. Each one seems like the greatest, and yet each one is subsumed to the totality.
Yeah, I mean, I always, when people talk about what's the greatest of the four operas, my response is, it's whichever one I'm watching at the time.
Well, for a long time, Götterdämmerung had actually edged out Valkyrie in my mind, just because it's so devastating. But then, willy-nilly, always Valkyrie finally gets the precedence, just because of, well, we'll talk about that more in detail. But from your analysis, you know, the Rheingold, it's always been a moving opera for me to watch, but frankly, you've interpreted some of my Hennids that were uninterpreted, and, you know, I think even Rheingold really has to rank as a great opera.
Yes, but the thing about Rheingold is only great in terms of the other operas.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But I mean, just to whet everybody's appetite, for many times, I mean, if I had just sit in the abstract and think of the operas, I've often come to Siegfried as my favorite opera.
Which is probably the least popular as far as, you know, being performed by opera companies and selling tickets and so forth.
Well, as we discuss, and we'll interact with some of the critics, and, you know, Siegfried is, I think, there's a book out by two philosophers called Finding an Ending. And it's a good book because it's a good book as a foil, I believe. I believe its reading of The Ring is fundamentally flawed. Well, that's a little strong. I believe its reading of Siegfried is fundamentally flawed. They view him as basically a stilted, one-dimensional character that is uninteresting. But I'm going to, in our discussion of Siegfried, try to rehabilitate him and understand him. See, they understand him as 21st century Western men, which is a very bad perspective to take, actually. Very limited, very beholden to scientific and feminized view of the views of the world. But I think if you understand Siegfried correctly, his character becomes much more compelling. In a sense, he is one-dimensional, but the dimension he encompasses is a glorious dimension.
Well, it has to
be. If you don't come to terms with it, and you don't see it, and if you're not tempted by it, you really don't understand, I believe, the whole opera.
Well, I mean, it has to be if Siegfried's Tod was the be-all and end-all and beginning and the root of everything that Wagner created thereafter.
Yeah, and these critics make Siegfried's death to be only significant in light of Brunhilde's love for Siegfried.
Interesting.
But that is not really a correct, I believe, understanding of Siegfried.
Hmm.
See, Siegfried is something that you have to struggle with in order to understand that which, in Wagner's worldview, goes beyond that. But if you don't struggle with it, if you don't, and I do, and you see, if you don't see the glory of it and the temptation of it, then you're not going to, I believe, really understand the entire cycle.
Right.
And these critics have really nothing to say about him that is compelling. I mean, in other words, they don't view him as a character that's compelling other than an object of affection for Brunhilde.
Well, I mean, just coming back to Rheingold briefly, I mean, the ending of Rheingold is so overwhelming and devastating, and even more so when you tie it to the parallelisms and archetypes that you described, that it can only really be compared to the endings of Valkyrie, Siegfried, and Götterdämmerung. I mean, each opera is so devastating within its own framework that it's almost unbelievable what Wagner created.
Well, and then you add the cumulative effect. I mean, just on a pure response to the operas. You know, and we're giving, you know, the danger of this type of discussion for people that aren't familiar with the operas is that, you know, we're trying to articulate what is, as Wittgenstein would say, is inarticulable. It's something deeper than what you can articulate. But yeah, the cumulative effect after a week spent with The Ring is, you know, even more. I mean, everything is amplified by one another.
Right.
But I'd say, you know, something similar is accomplished in Tristan. On a different level, different themes are being explored there, but Tristan is, on a certain level, as great as any of the Ring operas.
Right.
Now, eventually we're going to talk about Parsifal, and I must confess that even though many of the Wagnerians consider that the greatest of all operas, you know, greater than that which you could possibly conceive, actually, as some of them really, you know, imply in what they say. You know, I don't get that now, but I don't think I'll ever get that with Parsifal because I'm a Christian, and I think that there is a replacement, a genuine replacement of Christianity in Parsifal.
Interesting.
With something else. Whereas The Ring, though it's not a Christian opera, so much of it enlightens or can be understood within a Christian framework, or that is teaching us things that Christianity teaches, that I wouldn't call it at all a Christian, anti-Christian opera. It has certainly things in it that are not Christian. And I'm not talking about the mythology. I mean, that, you know, for one to get caught up on that really is not understanding it at all correctly. It's not the mythology itself. I mean,
right.
It's the, you know, the, well, we'll get to it and get to Demeron, the act of Brunhilde and the meaning of everything, and the mystery of everything that is problematic from a Christian point of view. But most of it is thoroughly human, thoroughly understandable in Christian terms, and it's something that I always viewed as, you know, Christianity encompasses all of this, but many Christians haven't got to that level yet. Not because of ignorance, but because they have been warped by a, you know, hybrid Christian and secular or pagan occult view of Christianity. But anyways,
well, that's right. I mean, they don't appreciate the richness, would be the way I would say it. And I'm reminded of how when I was studying as a 20-year-old in Tübingen, actually enjoying coffee and pastries more than studying, I'll have to confess, but I was attending a...
Well, why would you confess that? That would be a... Why wouldn't you enjoy the coffee and pastries more than that speaks to your favor?
Oh, thank you. But anyway, I was attending kind of a Pietist Methodist congregation at the time. In fact, this was before I was Reformed in my thinking, which happened about a year or two later. But I remember once I was at the pastor's house, and they were kind of talking in a very kind of excited, favorable fashion about Wagner's work, which to many American fundamentalists would probably seem like anathema, like the contradiction to their profession of faith. But I think that you've touched on something more deeper than that, that these very sincere, pious, Christian, German, simple folk realized that there were themes in The Ring of Wagner that are human, that Christianity is greater than, not less than.
That's right.
And many American Christians, especially of the fundamentalist stripe, invert and see as something less than Christian because they haven't thought about them profoundly enough.
Or anti-Christian, that's right. Yeah, I think, you know, the theme from the last of the Narnia books, further in and further up.
Right.
Things become more real as you go further in and further up, not less real. I mean, Christianity teaches us that all these things are real, but as you grow, they become things become more real. And Lewis put it another way. He says that talking about the books you like as a child, It's not that you grow up and you stop liking those books and start liking other books. It's that you continue to like those books, but you also begin to like other books as well. And, you know, to tie that into this, to, you know, use that point with what we're talking about, it's not that Christianity is something different than this. It's that Christianity is this, insofar as there's not errors in it. I mean, of course, I'm not saying Wagner got everything right. But it's all of that, and then more. In other words, it's not something that is other than this. It's something that is this, but it's more than this.
Right.
And I think that's the mistake of, you know, the modern... I mean, to make a basic apologetic point, which I tell my students all the time is, and it's basically a point that Doyabeard made. I think it's the point that, I mean, if he's remembered for anything, this is it. And he's not the first one to make it, but he articulated probably more clearly than anybody else, and that is, the non-believing mind is completely unoriginal. None of the things that we come up with is original, nor can be original. It can be perverted. I mean, the things that we come up with can pervert things that are not original. But we can never be, in a robust sense of the word, creative. We're only recreative. And so, in Wagner, you have a very... and I don't think... Wagner is a madman in many ways. He is both very conscious of what he's doing, and yet when he's in his groove, so to speak, he is unconscious. And in fact, he writes this. And he writes this himself. He's one of the few artists that, you know, you know everything about and more. You know, more than you need to know about him. But
interesting.
He tells you everything about himself. But when he's really writing, he writes at a level that is not reflective at all. Although he's reflected very deeply and profoundly about the nature of what he called music drama. And yet when he's writing his great works, he kind of throws his theories overboard and trusts his instincts, as he says.
Interesting.
And so everything at that level is, there's something that's not creative there. In an ultimate sense, he's tapping on things that are real. And so Christianity takes all those things and understands them in a way that is much more profound. Not exhaustive, because we can never have an exhaustive perspective. But it encompasses that and then more. And I think a lot of Christians really miss that. You know, Christianity becomes, you know, even in reform circles, we press the antithesis, as we say, but it's often misconstrued.
Exactly.
It's not that Wagner is a non-Christian artist.
Like,
I mean, certainly he is. I mean, he is very explicit about his anti-Christian beliefs. But, you know, to take him at that level and to form a stance against them is really a very poor application of the principle of antithesis.
That's right. It's denial of creation, finally.
Well, that's right. Because to think that that Wagner, I mean, it's the ultimate pride of man to think that they can really be anti-Christian in a exhaustive way. Because that's an impossibility, isn't it? To be anti-Christian would be for an intellectual, to be a thinker, to write, say, do nothing. The antithesis of Christianity is nothing.
Right. It's like the empty set.
And so, the more the anti-Christian speaks and works and creates, or recreates, you know, I'm speaking in a different sense of creates, but the more they're reflecting Christianity.
Well, that's a very important point, actually. because it kind of answers Van Til's dilemma as to how is it that the unbeliever is able to create such great things. And Van Til seems like he confesses ignorance at that point. But I think you've nailed something there. The true antithesis is the empty set. And so when the unbeliever does create something, he is creating something that is in the scope of God's creation.
Well, that's right. Perverted, but with Christian eyes, we can undo it. And we can see all the glories in... I mean, that's why, you know, the Darwinist, or would take whatever it is, you know, a lot of Christians read Wagner, the Darwinist, whatever it is, as in apologetic terms, which is a good, that's a fine perspective in one sense, right? I mean, we're going to stand opposed to their view, but the apologetic perspective is only one perspective.
Interesting. Yeah.
The other perspective is you read Darwin and you can learn a tremendous amount about things.
Interesting.
And the same with Wagner. The same with, you know, fill in the blank. Anybody that has done deep, profound thinking is somebody that is thinking God's thoughts after them, not knowing it, perverting it. But, you know, that's why the great pagan thinkers are worth studying.
Interesting. Well, you know, I'm struck by the fact that Wagner was born in 1813, I believe, in Leipzig, which was the year that the Prussians finally defeated Napoleon. It's a little bit off the, maybe a bit of a rabbit trail, but it is interesting how God's providence works together in many subtle ways.
Well, yeah, I mean, to kind of go stream of conscience, I mean, another thing about Wagner that's interesting is, except for, I think, a six-month period where he was working with a composer or a musician of a cathedral, and I think it was Leipzig as well. He came back to Leipzig later on. He had no formal training in music.
Interesting. Sort of like Luciano Pavarotti, but maybe a bit more profound than that.
Well, he had a lot more profound than that. But his very scant, you know, and it, I mean, to, you know, apropos nothing that we've been talking about, but, you know, an interesting point is that, you know, this model of education that we have really needs to be revisited. You know, okay, here's your curriculum for history, or to become a philosopher, or to become a musician, or to compose, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you look at all the greats, and, you know, none of them had the formal training. They were, you know, they were men that would gather what they needed. You know, the techne to him was just something, a matter of, yeah, I mean, he was weak in composition at points, and he learned that, you know, he realized that and he learned it, but he trusted his primal instincts. And, you know, that's, I think, not only for the artist, but for the philosopher, the thinker, that's what one has to do. I mean, the formal education model, I mean, there's, obviously, I mean, I teach at a Christian college, and there's something that's important about an education, but the idea that, you know, going through this system makes you a thinker or an artist or whatever it is that your degree is in, really is an absurdity. I mean, all you become is at best an expert in how other people have done it.
Right.
But it's not...
You're just a chimney sweep, kind of sweeping up behind someone else.
That's right. It's don't confuse that with, you know, it may give you certain tools and historical historical knowledge, but you know, one thing that you learn the older you get is how different people are and how, you know, different gifts can be expressed, that, you know, education can be just as much, I'm talking about formal education, just as much a curse as it is a blessing.
Hmm. Well, one thing this discussion has brought home to me is how much, bringing it back to the subject, how much is there in even the Rheingold, which is normally considered almost a throwaway. Normally you don't even need to listen to or understand Rheingold to, for example, listen to the Walküre, let alone the subsequent operas. Yet how much depth there is when you actually take the time to pause and contemplate the dilemmas of each of the characters.
Oh yeah, I mean, a good, you know, not that people are going to take me up on this, but a nice exercise would be to take, I mean, this is one level, is to take write the opera from the perspective of all the principles of it. You know, from Loge's perspective, Wotan's perspective, Albrecht's perspective.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's just one. And that will begin to help you to understand certain things. But, oh yeah, I mean, this is just meant to be a synopsis. And when we come back, after we complete the synopsis, we can come back and discuss some of the themes to it. But, yeah, I mean, we're just scratching the surface here. I mean, we haven't even touched barely on the music, which Wagner's theory on very much changes from the period of the 6 years I mentioned between Lohengrin and Rheingold. He begins the libretto of Siegfried's death. He's beginning to theorize about art, and he talks about the greatness of music. Well, he talks about the greatest art ever was the Greek tragedy. For many reasons, and one of the reasons is that it encompasses all the other arts. Mime, music, song, painting and scenery and all that kind of stuff. And so the Greek tragedy was the highest form of art. But since the Greeks, we've had the arts have been separated, which has been to the loss of humanity. And so you've had, you know, poetry without music. You've had a painting without song. I mean, all the divorces that have taken place.
Interesting.
And he talks about, you know, this you know, fragmentation has created a situation in which greatness has been achieved in all these different fields. Shakespeare in poetry. I mean, Wagner, of course, is a German speaker. Yet he acknowledges that, you know, nobody could imagine, you know, somebody like a Shakespeare. In my last class here in Virginia on Friday, I read a section from Shakespeare, and I tell my class that, yeah, Shakespeare is a great a playwright and a poet, but he's not the greatest in many ways. He's not the greatest. He's not a Milton in terms of depth, of understanding of the human situation. But what Shakespeare gives us is unique. It is unique. Wagner gets this right. he is able to marry up form and content. The language that he uses and the speeches or message he conveys are perfectly married up with one another. To a point that's really unbelievable. And I quote it from the... I'm searching it right here. From his later period. And the balance between language and meaning is... has become in Shakespeare at the end of his life almost one and the same. Prospero's farewell speech: "Ye elves of hills, brooks, standing lakes, and groves, and ye that on the sands with printless foot do chase the ebbing Neptune, and do fly him when he come back, you demi puppets that by moonshine do the green sour ringlets make, whereof the ewe not bites, and you whose pastime is to make midnight mushrooms that rejoice to hear the solemn curfew, by whose aid, weak masters though ye be, I have bedimmed the noontime sun, called forth the mutinous winds, and twixt the green sea and the azured vault set roaring war. To the dread rattling thunder have I given fire, and rifted Jove's stout oak with his own bolt. The strong base promontory have I made shake, and by the spurs plucked up the pine and cedar. Graves at my command have waked their sleepers oft, and led them forth. By my so potent art, that this rough magic I here abjure, and when I have required some heavenly music, which even now I do, to work mine end upon the senses that this airy charm is for, I break my staff, bury it certain fathoms in the earth, and deeper than did ever plummet sound, I'll drown my book." And Shakespeare, in this example of Prospero's speech, is a perfect marriage of form and meaning. In other words, you don't go to Shakespeare, I mean, Shakespeare does have great, you know, great humans in it, very recognizable humans. But the genius of Shakespeare is the marriage of his language and his meaning. And that is, I mean, if one is to study literature, I mean, a lot of English literature is a waste of time. But the great poets and the great writers are ones that marry the content with the language itself. And that's what Shakespeare was able to achieve that no others have. I mean, I've tried to make myself not like Shakespeare as much. And I'm greatly influenced by Wittgenstein. And Wittgenstein never really understood the greatness of Shakespeare. He did say that, well, that's maybe a deficiency in me, and other people have seen it, I just can't see it. But here's one case I would depart from Wittgenstein. I do see the greatness in Shakespeare. And it's not for his insight, it's not for his characterizations, but it's for his marriage of the meaning and the language itself. It's perfectly balanced in his later period and in many portions of his earlier period. But anyways, this is a long digression.
Well, I mean, I guess I would challenge that thesis, though, firstly, in that Shakespeare seems to be eminently translatable.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, look at Verdi. Did three of Verdi's greatest operas are basically Shakespeare plays.
But
Falstaff, Othello, and Macbeth.
Yeah, but you got to remember that none of Shakespeare's plays are original to him. He doesn't take any stories and...
So you think that the greatness of Verdi's production is independent or orthogonal to whatever it was that Shakespeare created?
Well, you know, I mean, this is taking us on another tangent, but I'm not a huge fan of Verdi. But, yeah, I mean, the greatness of it is the music. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, Shakespeare. It's all. You know, obviously, it's based upon Shakespeare, but he might as well base it upon what Shakespeare based his play on.
So in other words, when the Daigogini is in his study reading the translated works of Shakespeare, he's reading basically stories that might have been apart from Shakespeare.
Well, right. I mean, take Lear. I mean, Lear is a very simple story of a king who unwisely gives up his reign and is going to divide it between his daughters, but he first wants to hear what they think about him. And two of them, you know, flatter him. The other one speaks the truth, and he's upset at the third one who speaks the truth, and he gives us, you know, I mean, that's not quite mythic, but it's legendary. It's something, you know, it's translatable into any language. I mean, that story, and you could, you know, the lessons are just waiting for a creative mind to weave out of it. And Shakespeare is able to do that. I'm not saying Shakespeare's not, doesn't have insight, but he's just not the most insightful of all of our poets.
Interesting.
But in terms of, and that's why I think Wittgenstein doesn't understand the greatness of Shakespeare, because he's not a native English speaker. I mean, I can't imagine a native English speaker who really has spent time with Shakespeare and not being, you know, not just thinking that Shakespeare is a miracle. I mean, Shakespeare is a miracle. Just like Beethoven is a miracle. I mean, how can you possibly consciously write poetry, write music like that? It's impossible. I mean, and it's just, it may just be because of my lack of talent, but it's inconceivable. It's inconceivable to me. You know, how does, I think the movie Mozart did a nice job of this. I mean, to me,
Mozart or Amadeus?
Amadeus, the movie Amadeus, you know, it's all about this question. How can this ridiculous human being produce music like this?
Yeah.
And the answer the Greeks gave is the muses. And
right.
When somebody comes up with the better answer, then I'll listen. But so far, that's the best answer I've heard. It's the muses.
Well, I mean, substitute the spirit of God hovering over the
waters
and the earth.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean,
Genesis
it's not
one.
My point is saying the muses is that it's not something that you can. These people obviously haven't sat down and thought about what they're doing in the way in which we're doing now. It's just coming out of them.
Right.
It's just pouring. I mean, you hear some of the geniuses and they just say, well, it just comes to me.
Well,
I just write it.
It reminds me, Dr. Poitras at Westminster Seminary once said that, you know, when discussing the theory of meaning, we don't even know where our thoughts come from.
Well, that's right. And what makes one person intelligent and one person unintelligent?
That's right.
I mean, some thoughts come to, you know, it's just not a matter of taking a critical thinking course. I mean, that can improve something.
That's right, but only in a subsidiary sense.
That's right. I mean, what is? I mean, it's all miraculous. I mean,
it's all the spirit of God hovering over the earth and the waters.
That's right. Or to use another vocabulary, it's all magic.
Right.
Either way. I mean, and if you understand the right way, it's one of the same thing.
Right.
In the other sense, magic is, you know, the occult magic is science. It's instrumentalism. It's doing things.
The ultimate occult magic is science.
That's right. That's what it is. And the Christian magic is completely different from occult magic.
Right.
Because there's all, it's with Christianity, you know, there's a lot we can understand at certain levels, but at all the important levels, it all ends in mystery.
Right.
And in occult science,
I mean, how does a craftsman take a tree and rub it and scrape it and push it and scrape it some more and turn it into a Queen Anne secretary? It's just a pure miracle.
Yeah, but the modern scientists would have all the answers to that.
But none of them would address the main point.
That's right. That's why Wittgenstein is right. I mean, he says I quoted this many times before, but maybe to the listeners they haven't heard it, but science can answer all of our questions, can answer all the questions that, you know, are possible to it, but it hasn't dealt with anything important, hasn't touched on anything that's important.
Which is why I hope we can get back to the Tractatus, because I still believe that that's really the thesis of that work.
Well, you're right. That is the thesis of that book.
Which is why the logical positivists first thought they had their new Bible, and then they were horrified when they first began to suspect there was something amiss with his thesis.
Well, I don't think they wanted to incorporate Wagner in their little, I mean,
Wittgenstein.
The Vienna Circle people were the, you know, the most limited-minded people that you can imagine. We've got the answer to everything. And Wittgenstein can agree with them and say, yeah, but we've answered nothing. In other words, from a Christian point of view, yeah, I mean, it doesn't really matter what the logical positivist got it right or wrong. I mean, whatever. I mean, okay. Just give them what they have. But Wittgenstein is right. You know, like, okay, but you have nothing. You haven't said anything interesting. You haven't done any work. You haven't touched on anything that is of value to us.
Is this water here? Mm-hmm. Pure water? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's been my feeling with Wittgenstein.
Well, shall we call it evening?
Yeah. I think we may need to do maybe one more colloquy of an hour or less on Rheingold. Or maybe not. But I think you've raised enough themes that are worth further pondering and again.
Why don't we do the Valkyra next time, and then we'll...
Why don't we see where we're at mentally when it comes to the next time? It may be that, you know, we need to bracket Rheingold and come back to that at some future time, or maybe we'll feel that more needs to be unpacked. But I at least feel like it's possible that more should be said about Rheingold just based on the threads that you've brought to illumination in that synopsis. Or maybe it'll seem like the best thing to do is to move on with Valkyrie.
Yeah, I mean, that's my view, is we move on to Valkyrie, and then we'll, after we build up on to all four operas, we'll be able to go back and start, because we're just given a synopsis now. I mean, we haven't even...
I know, but what's incredible about it is that, you know, Rheingold, I think probably everybody would agree that Rheingold is the most dispensable as far as the perspective of an opera goer. Like, if you only can see three of the four operas, okay, we'll skip Rheingold then. But yet, when you actually hunker down and think about it...
No, it's like, to me, it would be like Bruden's Ass.
Who's?
Bruden's Ass, the medieval paradox. You know, you put a bale of hay between the... equidistance between ass and, you know, what would you give up? You know, would be...
So you're in stalemate.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rheingold, even though it is kind of, even musically, the simplest, but yet, the themes that are raised there are so profound.
Well, I mean,
and
the music
is actually, I don't want to understate the music, too. I mean, the music both has moments that are magnificent, and its overall effect is overwhelming as well.
Well, especially in Acts 1, Scene 1 and Scene 4, the music is...
Right.
Not quite as, anyway, I don't want to say it reaches the level of some of the other ones, but it's pretty close. We could talk another night on Rheingold, but on the musical point of view, but the opening of Rheingold is
Right, what is it, the E major chord or something?
Right, E minor. It's probably the greatest opening of any opera. I mean, better than even Die Walküre, the next one, which has a great opening. You know, and then some of the more famous ones, like Mozart's Figaro, you know, that's a famous opening. And but it's, I mean, there's nothing like it. It begins with the primordial. But when we get to, see, the thing about going through the Ring cycle is Wagner gives you subconsciously what he later gives you consciously. And so it's not until the prelude of Götterdämmerung, which you learn about the prelude to Rheingold, because it's talking about the Norns there, the weavers of wisdom, the weavers of fate.
Right.
They come back and fill in a lot of things. And they're not until the fourth opera.
Yes.
But, so that's why, you know, you gotta just kind of plod along, and then as you move along, you know, a lot of people complain there's some repetition in the Ring. Well, yes, but it's more like recapitulation in a biblical sense, right? I mean, Genesis 1. Well, why is Genesis 2 in there? It's telling us, you know, the same story. Well, what it's doing is it's telling the same story on a, focusing on a particular perspective of it, on a particular event, and elaborating upon it. And that's what Wagner does. He recapitulates, but in a focused and a penetrating way. And so, if you do move through the Ring, you will pick up on a lot of these things in a synoptic way, just if you just give a synopsis of it all. But then all the different angles you can take on the Ring, we can come back and after we give the synopsis.
Well, that's right. That. And I mean, it does share one feature that I at least appreciate about the Greek tragedy, whether anyone else agrees or not, but one of the things about Greek tragedy is that you can understand each speaker as he's speaking, you can understand his point of view almost perfectly. Mm. You can almost understand the story entirely from that speaker's point of view. And you can really see that very clearly in Rheingold, with the possible exception of Alberich.
Oh, no, I disagree. I see his perspective very clearly. I mean, in fact, I think that Albrecht's position is the one we see most clearly.
Well, you mean as sinners?
Well, yeah, I mean, we see
as vain, power-hungry.
Right, I mean,
you know, grasping.
As I think it was Lewis that said and talked about Preface to Paradise Lost, you know, he's pondering the question why all the interesting characters in literature are evil. And his answer is, well, because they're more basically they're more understandable, because we just take ourselves and, you know, basically appeal us, you know, take away some of the limitations.
Yeah, there might be some self-deception on my part in vainly supposing that I don't identify with Albrecht. Because,
well, I think probably it's more like you've seen through him, and so it's like, well, see, Wotan's fall, or whatever you want to call it,
self-deception,
is much more profound. I mean, it's like, you know, a Christian that has been, you know, a man who's been a Christian for 40 years. I mean, there's certain temptations that, you know, just aren't going to, you know, maybe a new Christian would be struggle with, but, you know, they're not going to struggle with those types of things. It'd be kind of almost laughable.
Right.
And so I think that's probably what your view on Albrecht is, because I think Albrecht is the most easily understood of all the characters.
Yeah, I think that may be true.
Right.
It may be that Wotan seems more sympathetic out of a sense of self-deception, where one thinks that one is above Albert's motivations, but one really isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you can model Votan in many ways as much deeper than Albrecht, but it's just somebody who is, you know, much... I mean, there's certain... You know, it's like the difference between the 17-year-old Negro in the inner city who's out to, you know, get laid versus the 40-year-old Christian who has been, you know, gradually compromising himself and falls into the sin of fornication.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Votan's like the second type. I mean, his is a much more complicated story and more compelling. I mean, in a way, the 17-year-old Negro is, by comparison, just almost innocent. I mean, what else do you expect?
Right.
I mean, of course they're going to do that.
So it almost lays the issues out more boldly. I mean, there might be some self-righteousness in the 40-year-old that gets entangled with his all of his subtleties.
Right, I mean, for the 17-year-old Negro, you'd be happy for them to, you know, if there was a culture that had a shotgun, you know, that would instigate a shotgun wedding and make the woman an honest woman, I mean, you'd probably be, that'd be, the whole issue would be settled and you'd be, everybody would be happy.
Right.
But with the 40-year-old man that's been a leader in the community and...
There's a whole road full of carcasses.
That's right.
Behind his pathway.
That's right.
Yeah, that's very true. It seems somehow that Votan is more lovable than...
Well, that's right, because he's... Well, he is. I mean, those things are true, too. I mean, he's more culpable, but... Because he shows more of us than Albrecht does. Albrecht shows certain dimensions. Votan shows many dimensions, and in fact, he shows many dimensions that we didn't even know, you know, some people don't even know exist.
And that's right.
Yeah, we were reading this before we turned on the recorder, if I could find it. But the...
Finding the ending?
No. Oh, here it is. In his... Well, this is kind of jumping the gun to the De Valkyra, but in his last speech, he says, Wenn Hoffnung gesehen, das Herz mir sengste, when hopeful yearning burned up in my heart. Hmm. I mean, what a great word, hopeful yearning.
Hmm.
You know, what is that? You know, you could say, what does that mean? Hopeful yearning, that's contentless. And yet even when I hear it in German, I know exactly what he's talking about. Hmm. But don't ask me to explain it.
Hmm.
But hopeful yearning. I mean, it's in a sense what C.S. Lewis tried to describe in Surprised by Joy. You know, this...
The essence of joy.
Longing... The unattainability and yet perfect comprehension of what it is, but at the same time not being able to either obtain it or identify it.
Indeed.
Yeah, to me that is what is, in a, I mean, maybe this is being a bit, exaggerated, but to me that's what being human is all about. I mean, is to understand both the joy that, you know, I have had those things that Lewis has talked about, those moments of complete joy, but it is, you know, and Garrison Keillor talks about happiness as being particular, sorrow, doldrums being general. And he's right about that. You can always say, I'm happy because of the sunshine, or because of the daffodil was blooming today, or because the, you know, whatever it is that is quotidian in particular.
Interesting.
But the searing joy is, you can't put your finger on it, but I've experienced it. But it's something that is something that is not articulatable. That's at least been my experience. So when C.S. Lewis writes like that, I know completely we understand. And I say that, and Votan understands that.
Mm-hmm.
When hopeful yearning, that just describes it perfectly, hopeful yearning.
Because
he understands it, and it's ungraspable at the same time.
Yeah, I like that idea of the Alberich and Votan as alter egos, which I actually never really had thought about before. But if you think of Alberich as really more of a match to what we really are in our nature, and yet not at all what we should be, and that we can, through regeneration, almost coupled to what Votan experiences, while at the same time realizing that with honesty we're more like Alberich in many ways. It's just so rich, you know, how this work touches down into human life and Christian life.
Yeah, it's
An unbelievable work. Like Brian McGee he was talking about Wagner, but in the process of talking about Wagner, he's talking about Shakespeare, and he says, yeah, Shakespeare did things that would be unbelievable unless you read that he did it. I mean, he really did do it, but if you just, somebody described his achievement, you wouldn't believe what he did. And I think that applies to Wagner. I mean, he really is. I mean, think about it. Think about sitting down and writing operas like that. It's completely unimaginable to me. Unimaginable.
Well, yeah, I mean.
And that's one of the greatnesses. You know, he's effeminate, he's a thief, he's silly in many ways, but King Ludwig of Bavaria, who was his benefactor, Wagner, later in life, and one of the things that he said is that, well, I'll always be known as somebody who recognized the genius of Wagner, and there is something to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain people, and this is getting on another point, but, you know, Wagner was bad with money, and, you know,
well, that's encouraging.
Well, but with other people's money.
Oh.
But in Wagner's case, somebody like Wagner, it's almost like, well, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I mean, what else are they going to do with their money? So what if he cheated them? We have the ring. We have Tristan. I mean, so what if he looted people of... I mean, it's like, well, it's...
Well, I don't
doesn't
know.
Take away his culpability, but it's in the grand scheme of things, it's like, well...
It's almost like they should take a certain pleasure in having been that instrument.
That's right. It's like, well, why are you begrudging them? Give it to them. Well, he doesn't need a third house or a second carriage or, you know, another set of robes or... Well, so what? Just let him keep writing. You know, I mean, just keep the guy happy.
Well, I mean, when I think of even the simplest little finger, what people would call a finger exercise on a piano, written by Bach or Haydn or Mozart, already that's so far above my comprehension of creating something like that, that by the time you lift it up to the level of, well, first Beethoven and then what Wagner did, I mean, that's several... That's like the seventh heaven, you know, to use St. Paul's language. So, I mean, I'm not even close to that. I guess what's wonderful is that we can appreciate it. Even those of us that lack the organ of creation can nevertheless appreciate it, what was created.
Well, that's right, and that's another thing from Amadeus, to mention that movie again, that's important, is, you know, I mean, forget the fictional nature of it, but is it Scolari?
Salieri.
You know, his mistake was, yeah, the guy is a total buffoon, but he has the muse. I mean, so just sit back and, I mean, he wasn't able to take it in. It was always a matter of, why couldn't I have that talent? But who cares? I mean, who cares?
Right. So
I mean, Mozart, what did he do to have it? I mean, it's not like he really studied music and
that's right.
The insight.
Not at all.
It's the...
It just bubbled up.
And so we're in even better position because we have Mozart now. We have those things.
So Salieri, in a sense, did worship God in recognizing what God was creating through Mozart. But yet he loved himself even more. And therefore he wanted to destroy Mozart. Again, purely fictional. The real Salieri probably wasn't like that at all. So treating this just as a fictional story that still illuminates human nature. I hope that in discussing it we're not insulting the real Salieri.
Right, it's like Nietzsche's grand mistake. You know, I can't stand the thought of there being a God and I'm not he.
Exactly.
I mean, what a mistake. I mean, just that there is a God.
So, when Salieri recognized the voice of God speaking through Mozart, that by itself was fine and should have been a terminus for him. Not to worship Mozart, but to worship the spirit behind Mozart.
That's right. That's the lesson you should learn. Like, well, look at this guy. He's culturally, intellectually, in almost any sense, a nothing. You know, and a yahoo, as Swift was saying. But you know, go figure. He has it.
Right. And
praise be to God that we have him. That the Spirit is coming through him.
Right. So God had already composed all of these things in eternity.
Well, I'm just thinking of, I mean, we're
obviously
following, going far afield, but think of the heavenly music.
Well,
I mean, Mozart.
Exactly. Now, Dr. Edgar said that, you know, we'll clearly have Bach in heaven. And I think he's right at one level. But it's sort of like Bach squared and Bach cubed, Bach to the fourth power. And same with Beethoven and Wagner and so forth. All of these men were breathed into by God, in a sense.
Well, that's
with music that he had already composed in eternity.
And that's what Tolkien picks up on his version of the creation myth. It's all music. And it's all from the mind of Eru, the Ilúvatar,
so,
the Soul Father.
So the fictional Salieri was not wrong in his insight, but he was wrong in his reaction to the insight.
Right. You know, why don't I, you know, why don't, it's a matter of just a mistake.
Mozart
why don't
was,
I have that gift?
Yeah, Mozart was indeed a nothing, as we all are.
And the Christian, I mean, there's ultimately an answer in God's mystery, but, you know, we'll never know, I don't believe. You know, the answer, Christian response is, go figure.
Well, you mean as far as why this guy is the instrument,
right,
and not that guy?
Right. Why him and not me?
Right.
Go figure.
Yeah, right.
I say that glibly because I'm not an artist. But that puts me at an advantage, I think. Because that's not my temptation. My temptation is in other ways. But you can see somebody who is talented, but without the muse, somebody like a Mendelssohn. I mean, obviously extremely talented, but doesn't have it.
Well, I mean, I guess I would want to say instead of that, I don't know if this ins and outs of Mendelssohn per se, but each man that has that gift of music, his vessel is filled to whatever size his vessel is. And that's something good. I mean, it kind of reminds me of Eric Liddell in Chariots of Fire, whether it was made up or real, I don't know, but how he tells the sister that when he's running in a race, he feels God moving through his legs, in a sense. I mean, he feels that he's just the instrument, even in his running. And that he kind of exalts in that.
Right, and that's one of the themes of the Chariots of Fire that comes out, that, you know, Abraham and Eric, one of them is out for glory, but one of them, the glory is
the sense of being an instrument of God.
Right, I mean, think about it. I mean, does Eric Lyle care if he gets a laurel leaf or a trinket?
Well, maybe not ultimately, but I mean, he also does desire to win, but yet he won't compromise any.
Well, yeah, but
principle.
But I would say that's a shallow reading because, yeah, I mean, if you're not playing to win, you're not playing. But if you play to win and lose, then you haven't lost anything in it. In other words, it's with Eric, given the movies, Eric Liddell, it wouldn't have been meant anything to him to lose.
Well, does that capture his eagerness in scampering down the runway, though?
Well, sure. I mean, from a game's point of view, of course he wants to. Like I said, you're not playing if you're not trying to win. But he's not. But his joy was in the action, not in the conclusion.
Yes, but
whereas Abraham was the typical Jew who was always looking to the bottom line.
Right. But Eric, I mean, I agree with you, provided you don't say that Eric was sort of apathetic as to...
No, it's not apathetic, because you're not playing to win that way.
He had a real joy in excelling and in being mighty on his legs. But he felt like it wasn't something inherent in himself. It was almost like, as it were, the Spirit of God breathing into his very limbs. I mean, I almost see a direct analogy between Liddell's running and Mozart's composing. Each of them just breathed into by something outside of themselves. And Eric Liddell was praising God for that and not wanting to despise that gift. I mean, I think we're in violent agreement. I guess what you're saying is that with that understanding, and then if whether they won or lost that particular stupid little heat in Scotland somewhere wasn't important anymore. I suppose that's true, but maybe that's something to reflect upon further.
Well, next session, let's do Dvalkur then.
Okay. Well, I hope you readers have enjoyed this. We'll talk to you again soon.